Good evening.
Good evening.
Well, just before we leave the six lines of the illumination hexagram for a while, one last word about this, because I found in my notes these printouts from the Chinese canon, the Zoku Zokyo, which is like a supplement to the Taisho Tripitaka. This was some time ago, and studying this kind of thing, and you know, doing a digital search for Jewel Mirror Samadhi, and it pulled up, most of it's just written, but it pulled up these diagrams, the hexagram, and I'm not sure who wrote this. This is a text called The Original Meaning of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, but it's a Chinese commentary, old enough to be included in the canon, what, sometime after Dongshan. You know, I don't know about deciphering this. There's not much text, but you know, you see it has the circle diagrams and the hexagram broken up in different way here than the way we were talking about it, because there's different versions. But the part that really caught my interest was this one, where it has, you know, it's splitting up into pairs instead of trigrams in a different kind of way, but it has the names of the five positions. One, two here, three in the middle, and four, five up on the top. You know, I don't know exactly, you know, what. And then it has the three stacked up, they make three, it says over here. And then it actually says, for this pair, it says Bodhi, this pair says Dharmakaya, and this pair says, like, Vimoksha, or liberation in Chinese. But the interesting part for me was that down here it says Jijiyu Zamai, which is, as most of you probably know, Dogen has... It's one of Dogen's main descriptions of his Zazen practice in the Shobogenzo Bendowa. We translate it as self-enjoyment samadhi, self-fulfilling samadhi, or the self receiving its function, or receptive samadhi. These are all translations. Very important term for Dogen. And I always wondered where he got that. This might have actually come from searching, you know, you can do these digital searches of the canon, searching for that term. And as I recall, because, you know, Dogen gets most of his stuff from Chinese Zen, because he was the beginning of Japanese Zen. And I think this is maybe the only place, or one of the only places, that this term, Jijiyu Zamai, appears in the whole Chinese canon. The self receiving its function, samadhi. And then it's contrasted with, so that's just, this is Jijiyu Zamai in this Chinese text. And then this is Tajuyu Zamai. Ta means other, as opposed to self. And I have heard Menzan Zenji in Japan, Soto Zen teacher, talk about these two, self-fulfilling samadhi and other-fulfilling samadhi. And I think in that case he talks about it as the self, or the self-enjoyment samadhi, the enjoyment of the self just receiving its function from all things. I think it's another name for mirror awareness. Is Buddha's enjoyment, and then Buddha helps others, you could say, helps others to enjoy their function, their, to enjoy their reception and function. That's one a bit rough way of talking about self-fulfilling samadhi and other-fulfilling samadhi. One's about just the Buddha enjoying his realization under the Bodhi tree and like, I could just hang out here forever and like, no one's going to understand this anyway. And then the chakra, the deva said, please, there's beings with little dust in their eyes, please. Gotama, the newly realized Buddha, please go to try to help others realize what you have. So that's like Buddha's active work of helping others to enjoy themselves receiving their function. Does that make sense? Self-receiving and samadhi and other fulfilling samadhi. It's kind of obscure because that's about all we know of these from Menzan's little explanation, which is kind of like what I just said. And then this illumination hexagram where it's, you know, and this text is very obscure on the bottom here, and it'd be nice to get someone who's more proficient in Chinese to translate this little bit of text here. But the one little part about these two terms, which doesn't give much to go on, but it says something like, the inner trigram of yin and yang abiding position, maybe we could say abiding position of the inner trigram of yin and yang, is for or is because of or is it result of self-enjoyment, samadhi, the text says. And then the outer, that's the inner trigram of yin and yang. This is my, you know, a little bit rough translation from earlier, like an hour ago, looking at this. The outer trigram of yin and yang divination position is the result of other enjoyment, samadhi. So I think there's some obscure, you know, thing going on here, and the text itself doesn't explain what, there might be something earlier about this, but what the inner trigram abiding position and the outer trigram divination position refer to. So it's all a little bit speculation, but I couldn't resist bringing this up because to me, it's really exciting that this very rare, unusual term in Chinese Zen that becomes a very important for Dogen, one of the only places it's found, is right in the middle of the illumination hexagram. So again, I think I mentioned before that Dogen was not so keen on this five positions thing, and this, you know, these five transformations and all this stuff because he thought it was too complicated, so he doesn't really talk about it. But it could be that he's like, well, the heart of this matter is this self-fulfilling samadhi, so I'm just going to talk about it like that. And also, if you look at maybe we bring this up again in the class on the five positions, but in the terms of the progression of those five positions, it kind of looks like there's a transition from kind of a self-awakening to the activation of the bodhisattva vows and helping others fill a well with snow and so on. Remember from last week, there's this, those five positions move from a kind of inner realization emphasis to an outer benefiting emphasis. And so something in here, in these early positions of the five positions, I'm not exactly sure how they match up with how they're lining up these three transformations in these five positions with these descriptions here, but that there's a movement from self-enjoyment samadhi to other enjoyment samadhi. And it's kind of, you know, they're centered around, the two terms are centered around the center position. But I also feel like the description of this, of the second of the five positions is, that Dongshan's verse is about the old woman coming upon a mirror, seeing her reflection. I feel like that is very similar to this self-receiving its function from the mirror or in the mirror. So we could talk about that, or we could say this is highly speculative and kind of gnarly territory, and we don't know Chinese, and I would say let's go on. But I just wanted to mention that, and maybe further research could be carried out.
One comment. It just seems to me that because of the origin of this text and because the I Ching is so deeply rooted in the light and dark and the yin and yang and the active, and the receptive, that's really, it's just like, it's hard because you can't quite see what's going on, but it's this even more to me centers on that.
Active and receptive. I think the basic thing of black and white, yin and yang, is all through this dual mirror samadhi, all through, the two truths. You could say this is a Chinese poem about the two truths. The ultimate truth is like the just kind of passive, receptive emptiness, and that active relative truth where function happens in the world, and the integration of those two, integration of yin and yang, light and dark, broken and solid lines. All of that plays in, and when you start getting more than one relationship between them, and you have five relationships between them, then things get very complicated, as we know. But I think that's very true, that these basic two sides are definitely woven through this poem again and again. It's going to keep coming back to that point as we continue. We're at subtly included within the true, inquiry and response come up together. And this is, as you might recall, I mentioned this thing about the five positions. Are these, one way of looking at it is the five times this true character appears, and this is the last one. So this could, this particular line could refer to this fifth position of arriving within together. Sometimes called, is the name of the fifth rank, fifth position of Dongshan, arriving within together, which is, sounds very much like subtly included within the true, or the ultimate, inquire and response come up together. Subtly, mysteriously included in this dark ultimate truth where nothing can be distinguished. Within that, there's actually inquire and response. Maybe another way of talking about interdependent arising. Interdependent co-arising means simultaneous. Conditions and result simultaneously come up together. But inquire in response, so some commentators say this is pointing towards teacher-student relationship, like we have the story about the pecking, the chick, the baby chick, pecking at the egg from the inside. It's like the student trying to break out of the shell, they're stuck in the shell, and they're doing that work, pecking from the inside, and the teacher's like the mother hen pecking from the outside, helping. And if they just try to break the egg from the outside, the little chick will get born too quickly and die. I think in terms of chickens, that's probably what happens. So, but yet, you know, I don't know actually in terms of real chickens, if the hens ever peck from the outside. Does anyone know that? If mother hens ever peck on the outside? Generally the chick is breaking out from the inside, right?
I bet they do.
They might. And they might, especially if the chick is very slow pecking out and it's not working and they can tell they're pecking in, they might, okay, let's give them a little help. So that would be interesting to find out if it really is a mutual thing sometimes like that. I think just like in practice, generally we have to do this work. No one can do it for us. And yet there's help from outside. We could also talk about sentient being in the shell and Buddha on the outside. Kano Doko, the mystical communion of sentient being and Buddha together trying to break the shell. You could say in that case too, the shell that separates them, right? It separates the sentient being chick from the Buddha hen. There seems to be this shell in between them. Break the shell, so there's no more separation.
What could be that shell?
The shell?
What could that be?
Delusion.
Delusion,
basic belief that the shell, any kind of shell, truly exists.
The belief that it exists.
You have to break that belief. Yeah, that it's a solid shell. So in that metaphor, it's a little funny because it's like we have to break the belief, but it's actually like chipping away. So it might be like, you know, maybe there's a way that the baby chick could be like, okay, this is hard work pecking here. Let's just rest a minute here. Rest, just like really rest inside the shell here, and like looks around like, wait a second, where's the shell? In real chick life, I don't know if it ever works that way. But we don't know, maybe. Sometimes. A little bit like sudden and gradual. That issue is going to come up soon. But inquiry and response is more literally a more literal translation is actually drumming and singing. Subtly included within the two, drumming and singing come up together.
Mm-hmm.
Musicians like that.
Wow, that's listening.
Or, and also come up, you could also translate as celebrate. Subtly held would be another word. Subtly or mysteriously held within the true, which we mean the dark ultimate. Drumming and singing celebrate together. Drum and sing, or you could also translate it as hitting and yelling come up together, which I think some commentator made the point that maybe like hitting and shouting, but also one interpretation would be like somebody hits you and you shout like ow, you know, it's like an interdependent arising, right? Like, I don't just yell about anything, but when hit, ow! It's like a response, you know? I think it's kind of nice. All of them kind of work. Hitting and ow! Come up together. It's just like the function, I think it's just a poetic way of talking about interdependent arising. Drumming and singing in the band, you know? Which one is leading? Is the drum beat keeping the time? Or is the singer trying to kind of speed up the drum beat? We have this issue actually sometimes in service. Yeah. Yeah. We're chanting, and the mukugyo is the role of the mukugyo player is to set the beat for, set the pace for everyone. It's kind of their job. But sometimes they're really absorbed in playing and they get out of a line with the singing, the chanting. And it's interesting because they really are kind of setting the pace. We really do go with them. But if they get too far off, we can't go with them. You'll probably know this experience, right? If they start to get out of time, the chanting just falls apart. We can't just, or if they change very suddenly, we can't keep up. So it's a beautiful, I think, chanting with the Mahuyo is a beautiful demonstration of this interdependence. They're setting the pace, and we're also setting the pace with them. It's not so clear who's leading, and yet if anybody stops, the whole thing falls apart.
Drumming and dancing are really that way too.
Mm.
Drumming when I couldn't tell if the dancers were making the drum happen.
Ah.
The dance.
You're an African dancer. Right?
Yeah, not practice, but not dancing the drum.
African drumming. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as a deadhead, I know this well too. Is this energy coming from the assembly? The audience is like feeding the band, sometimes very palpably, and the band is feeding the audience, and there's a mystical communion, I must say, on good nights. That's what would keep me coming back again and again.
No help from any other outside substances.
Well, everything's included. Nothing's excluded from the mystical communion.
Right.
So, communing with the source, travel the pathways, embrace the territory, and treasure the road. Or communing or pervading or reaching the source. This character is going to source and pathways. If you look at those characters, it's the second and the fourth character are going to play out in the like the next few lines. He's going to keep bringing them up, and the translation doesn't really repeat that way. But and you can also see the communing character is the same. It means like to pervade, could be penetrate the source and penetrate the pathways, pervade. The source pervade the pathways, and then embrace territory, embrace the road. You see how those two characters are the same? So in the poem, they're repeating, but in the translation, they just decided to use different ones. So you could say pervading the source and pervading the pathways. And then similarly, embracing the territory and embracing the road. So I think same idea. The capital, right? The territory of land, and then all the roads that lead in. You could say the emperor or the government embraces the territory and also embraces all the roads around it, or embraces the source and the pathways to the source. So you could look at it as the realization. In stillness, the non meditation of just being, and then the meditation practice that approaches that. So you could say, even like practice and realization. The pathways, the path of practice, and the source is like the realization, or the territory is like the realization, and the road is like the practice. It leads to the territory. So, as we know, Dogen is really big on practice and realization are not two. And this line kind of brings that out. You know, we're talking about, it's kind of commenting on the previous line, I would say, subtly included within the true oneness. Inquire and response come up together. Then within this oneness, there's communing with the source, and there's communing with the pathways. There's communing with realization and communing with practice.
How are the source and the territory related?
I think same. I hear them as just two different, maybe poetically it works.
Mm-hmm.
But I hear that, yeah, the territory and the source are the same thing, and the pathways and the road are the same. Maybe territory and road has a particular connotation of like on the land, literally the roads and the territory and the source and the pathways is maybe more like about practice.
Mm-hmm.
like Dharma practice, maybe. But I think same, two different lines saying same thing. Also, you could hear, so practice and realization are equally communed with. I could also hear it as, again, the two truths. You could hear that realization is like the ultimate truth, and practice is like the conventional truth that you do. Like, you sit in a particular posture, you take this posture, but this posture, conventional practice of this posture, is, as Dogen says, not the least bit separate from the ultimate truth of realization or verification of Buddha. So Dogen's practice and realization are not two. I think we could beautifully interpret as the ultimate and the relative are not two, which is true. It's a practice-oriented expression of the two truths, Dogen's statement. Does that make sense? Practice and realization are not two. Is a kind of practical type of statement about our practice, but you could hear that same statement as based on the union of the two truths. Yeah? I think it's the same principle, but I usually don't think of it, practice and realization are not two, as like the relative and the ultimate are not two, but I think it's the same, and it's in there. Yeah.
Practice and realization can they be considered to be interdependent? I mean, literally interdependent.
That's like that question. Then could be said, well, if they were interdependent, then we would maybe have to say the two truths are interdependent. And I remember we had this discussion in some class at one point about this, or maybe it was a discussion I had with, I think, this particular Buddhist scholar. I think it's actually a kind of a tricky question, to be honest. I think, especially if we talk about the two truths, if the two truths are you know, that we say they're not two, but if we say they're interdependent, it's a little funny, because the ultimate truth doesn't depend on anything. From the perspective of the ultimate, there's no dependence. There's no coming and going. There's no, relation to anything else, because it's all-inclusiveness.
And the realization is the ultimate?
That's what I'm proposing. We could kind of line these up that way. So even if we talk about realization, or, technically for Dogen, it really means like verification or confirmation. And I hear it as like the direct experience of verifying Buddha's mind is not separate from that activity of practice. That's how I understand Dogen's practice and realization are not two. The verification, it's inconceivable verification. And so if we say that verification depends on the practice, I think we might be able to say that. This is something that maybe we could take home and contemplate. Because if we say it depends, then it's a little, I think it starts to get a little dualistic. Even, interdependence is not very dualistic, right? Dependent co-arising is not very dualistic, but it's a little bit compared to the ultimate truth, where there's no arising and no ceasing, just complete inconceivable suchness. Non-duality itself. Because in dependent co-arising, we're saying, the flower depends on the sunshine. So that already, they're interdependent, so they're not really separate, but we have a duality there. We have two different things that we can talk about, flower and sunshine. So even though they're interdependent, there's still there's a kind of duality.
Does that exist with the practice of realization?
Well, I think, now we're comparing the interdependent arising which is we could call, I would propose, is the conventional truth, actually. It's true, but it's actually just an appearance. In reality, nothing is arising, even interdependently. And so then if we say, then we could say, well, does that ultimate truth of no arising and no ceasing depend on arising and ceasing? You know, provisionally, for now, I would say, I feel like I can't really say that. I wouldn't want to go so far as to say that. But then the interesting question is, then what's the relationship between these two truths if they're not interdependent? And they're not two, the two truths, classically in Indian Buddhism as well as in Zen, they're not separate, and yet they're not totally identical either, because they're called the two truths. You can't just mush it all into one. So if we have two truths, they're not two, and they're not one, what's the relationship? I think it's an interesting question, is are they interdependent? And again, for now, I would say that relationship is more subtle even than interdependence. It's like they're contradictorily identical. This is even in the Heart Sutra, this plays out. Form itself is emptiness. Do we say form is dependent on emptiness? I don't think we can say anything is dependent on emptiness.
A person called Kokyo,
yes.
I wrote his note down or something that he said,
yes,
at a class,
yes,
that I found very helpful. And maybe it's not so much that they're interdependent,
mm-hmm,
but they're not separate. You said form is an expression of emptiness.
Mm, okay.
And then you said this, and emptiness is the true nature of form.
Thank you.
And that helped me very much, because it's a way of thinking of, it's like it is, they're not separate, but there's, you know, their expressions.
That's good.
Yeah.
I'll have to have a conversation with him. Is it Kokyo?
Yeah, Kokyo.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll send you the book.
I like that emptiness is the true nature of form, which is different than saying it depends on form. And form is an expression or manifestation of emptiness, which is a little different than saying, that's a little closer to saying it depends on emptiness. But the first one, that emptiness is the actual true nature of form, that's not a dependent relationship. But it's a very intimate relationship, right? The true nature, you know, there's me and my true nature. Those are like, you can't even be more intimate, and yet I'm not dependent really on my true nature. My true nature is not dependent on me.
Well, and the other one too, though, I think is the same thing. I mean, to put it in really practical terms, you know, form is an expression of emptiness. I mean, I think of it in terms of, say, human behavior, mm-hmm, right? We could be completely coming from and grounded in our unity and our commonality,
mm-hmm,
but our forms may look different.
Mm-hmm.
You may have one opinion and I may have a different opinion, different form, and yet they're an expression of something that is not
inconceivable.
Separate. The form is different.
Mm-hmm.
But the ground or the...
Yeah. I mean, also we have to be careful not to make emptiness into some kind of sort of metaphysical ground,
right,
like you know, that things like the Tao, I think is like that. My understanding, my limited understanding of the Tao and Taoism, is like it's like almost like this. It's an inconceivable mysterious creation out of which everything comes.
Right.
And when and Buddhism tried to bring that in there, you know, we call the Buddha way. They try to bring that into the Taoist concept, but I think it's a little different from emptiness.
I agree. Yeah.
Indian version of emptiness. Yeah. So therefore to say form is an expression of emptiness, or if we say it's a manifestation of, it starts to sound like there's this whole emptiness out of which things emerge, which I think is a little funny. Now, Buddha nature, we can start to do that a little more with, I think. Buddha nature's emptiness, but it's the empty nature of mind, of a living being, traditionally. So it's like, we could say, from the empty nature of mind, things like perceptions and thoughts can arise and manifest. I think it's a little more possible to say that dualistic thoughts can be expressions of this non-dual Buddha nature that's really the source. But emptiness as a kind of like in the Madhyamaka school as a kind of philosophical concept of the, you know, the absence, you know, it's really, if we define emptiness as the absence of independent existence, you don't really say that like things come out of an absence.
Yeah. Not for the thing we would picture, but for the mode of relationality, the front and the back of the hand.
Yeah. Although, you know, if we, as a metaphor, because we can actually, I think, we can say that the front and the back of the hand are dependent on each other.
Mm.
You know, if we just take it literally as the hand.
I didn't mean to take it literally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If we take it literally, they are dependent because their ideas, you know, about the same hand. But as a metaphor, yeah. Another metaphor, who used this? Was it Hakuin or somewhere around this issue of the black and the white and the five positions thing, somewhere I think in Chinese Zen, maybe Japanese Zen, there's an image of like you have these circles of black and white, right? And then the fifth position, one image is it's a disc, and one side's white and one's black, and it's like a top. You spin it like a top very fast. And the black and the white just kind of blend into gray. It maybe would look like a gray sphere if you spun a disc, a black and white disc like that. And where there are two sides of one disc, but they actually just become one gray sphere.
Mm.
And playing with that, the hand thing a little bit.
Maybe we should bring some in.
We could try making one of those. Yeah, that would be interesting. Yeah, I think it's worth stopping to have a little bit longer discussion about these two truths, because I think this is all woven all through this poem.
Mm-hmm. This truth business. I know, you know, it's endless, and I'm a fanaticism here, and I know you know
where you're going.
Where I'm going back, probably. But what I find is that what I just realized when you mentioned, you know, Taoism again, is that in my mind I keep trying to make Zen Taoist. And I don't want Zen not to be. I want to have it be, you know, a Zen Buddhist.
Identical.
But yeah, I want it to be with a Taoist understanding, because I don't accept this truth business. I don't think we have any business talking about truth. Why? Because we don't know anything about it, really. That's what I mean. And we say we don't, but we still talk about the truth. How do we know anything about any truth? Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, and I've heard you say, well, it's inconceivable, or this is inconceivable, you know, or it's mysterious. Well, those are the words that I'm comfortable with. Truth, I'm only comfortable with, like, let's say, in musical or emotional terms. You knowing the truth, you know it from the belly, and you can know it, but you can never say it. You can never, you know when it's true, but you can't say you know what truth is. You know?
How about the word reality? Does that have the same flavor?
Yeah, same disturbing.
Well, it's interesting because I think we could say that, you know, some Indians chose that word satya, truth, to to for these two truths, which literally does mean truth. But we could say that the ultimate truth, we can't know it as truth. I mean, that's the definition of it, right?
That's the definition.
So they're maybe playing with that. They're playing with it. It's a truth that you can't know.
The truth.
Yeah, the ultimate truth you can't know. So that's the kind of truth it is. But conventional truth, which is like the law of interdependence and cause and effect and so on, that, in a way, we can know it through logic.
Yeah, that we can play with.
We can play with it anyway, yeah.
So it's kind of a joke to say ultimate truth.
It is.
In a way.
It's kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's, in a way, it's kind of a joke to say conventional truth, too. I mean, what could it, yeah. And yet, ultimate truth can be, and we're saying it can't be known by the conceptual mind, but it can be known without touching it.
No,
and that's what you're talking about, maybe in the belly or.
But trying, you know, to say that we know anything about it. You know, yeah, it's disturbing. You know, Tao sounds like, you know, we don't know, you know, and yet we still work with it, you know.
I mean, the Tao that can be spoken of is not the true Tao.
Right, you know. Mm-hmm.
And I think, I think that's true of the ultimate truth, too. That, I mean, the people who come up with words like ultimate truth, they would say the ultimate truth that can be spoken of is not the actual ultimate truth. Yeah, they would say that. Yeah, so it's maybe, you know, what do you call it? You could just call it the ultimate and the conventional. But then, you know, what are these two things? I think truth, in a way, emphasizes the fact that it's not total delusion. Maybe that's part of truth as opposed to total falsity, you know, as opposed to some graspable kind of truth. But, yeah.
Yeah,
it's just problematic, the words. Yeah, so. And I think Taoism did have a profound effect on Zen in China, and very similar in many ways, and they both incorporated each other as time went on in various ways, and yet they're not. I don't think we want to say they're identical. In fact, Dogen has, I think Dogen's essay called Butsudo, Shobogenzo Butsudo, Buddha Way, is he gets into some critique of Taoism. He gets a little bit on one of his Dogen rants. And I think it's particularly about cause and effect. He says Taoism doesn't emphasize this dependent co-arising in quite that way. And we can look for places maybe where it talks about the harmony of nature, that's for sure, but the specific workings of cause and effect, and as a logical proof of emptiness, which is Nagarjuna's whole thing, so that kind of thing you don't really find in Taoism. It's simpler in a way. It's just being in the mountains. subtly included within the true. Inquiry and response come up together. Communing with the source, communing with the pathways, embracing the territory, embracing the road. Respecting this is fortunate. Do not neglect it. Or devotion to this is auspicious. Do not neglect it. That's just nothing much going on there. It just sounds like a kind of an admonition of like, this is amazing here. Like, you know, don't ignore this. This is like the Dharma is, the heart of the Dharma is right here. So, don't think this isn't important. We could maybe say naturally real yet inconceivable or subtle. It's not within the province or category of delusion or enlightenment. So naturally real is, so my teacher Tenshin Roshi, this is his name here, Tenshin.
Naturally real,
the same characters, Tenshin. And he likes to tell the story that when Suzuki Roshi ordained him as a priest and gave him that name, I think in the ceremony he might have even said, your name is Tenshin Zenki. Your friends will call you Tenshin. And Tenshin means that Reb is Reb.
He certainly is.
He is, yeah. And I think that's a good definition of this term. It's like a Buddhist term, naturally real, that, you know, literally, the characters means, the first character is heaven truth, heavenly truth, or heaven's reality or truth. I think the idea there is that it's like, maybe a little bit Taoist version of heaven, like the natural accord of heaven. There's a nice way it was put here. Let's see. That this term, as a Buddhist term, denotes that which is given by heaven, utterly untainted by human artifice, perhaps coming close to the English term nature. That actually this compound, Tenshin, owed its currency to chapter 31 of Chuangzi, the great Taoist founder. Laozi and Chuangzi are like considered the two good, like, founders, maybe, of Taoism, if you could say that. So Chuangzi says, truth is what is received from heaven. It is what is and cannot be altered. Hey, there you go, truth in Taoism. Chuangzi.
Can't be a Taoist either.
And it sounds like maybe they're using that character, which means true or real, which I can't remember if that's what they use for satya, to translate the Sanskrit satya. I think maybe. I have a friend named Satya, who's Satya Vayu. He goes by Satya, but his Shin Fu, truth wind. But he kind of like he liked to go by the Sanskrit, so he changed it to Satya. Naturally real, which is I think a description of the dual mirror samadhi. Now we're still, all of this is describing dual mirror samadhi. It's like without, untainted by human artifice, what's received from heaven. Maybe in Taoism, heaven's like ultimate. It is what is. Naturally real, yet mysterious or subtle or inconceivable. That character shows up a lot through the dual mirror samadhi too. That's Mio. It's not within the category of delusion or enlightenment. So it doesn't, you know, fall into that duality. These are the standard. These are the characters that Dogen uses in the Genjo Koan about great realization of delusion and great delusion about realization, and how because of that relationship, they kind of, they're not so separate, according to Dogen there. So this is kind of the same idea. It's not within the categories of this, our, you know, fixed idea of delusion over here and enlightenment over here. Let's see. With causal conditions quiescently it shines bright in its fineness. Oh wait, is that the right line? In its fineness it fits into spaciousness, in its greatness it is utterly beyond location. In its fineness or minuteness it enters into where there's no gap, would be another translation. In its fineness it enters where there's no gap. It's kind of nice, huh? Like between two cracks there's no gap at all. It's so fine it enters where there's no gap at all. The jewel mirror samadhi does. Yeah. In its greatness, it is utterly beyond location or dimension or boundaries. So, you see, you can say it's extremely subtle and fine, has no space at all, like a pinpoint, and yet it's huge, vast. This jewel mirror is great. It's just these two different sides. It doesn't fall into any of that, right? This is kind of like spatial. It doesn't fall into spatial extremes. It has no location.
It has no fineness.
It has no fineness. Yeah.
It
no. Yeah. Because any even a little fineness wouldn't be able to fit where there's no gap. So. Yeah. Yeah. It enters where there's no gap. Its greatness is utterly beyond location. A hair's breadth deviation will fail to accord with a proper attunement or a proper harmony. And these are apparently... We missed the line, right? With cause or conditions, time and season, quiescently it shines bright. With cause or conditions, time and season, so this is like cause and effect, the conventional world. Causes, conditions, time, season, in that all those relative changes of the world, quiescently it shines bright, which is quiescent and shining is reminiscent of what we call silent illumination, a term which was coined later in Soto Zen in China, silent illumination. It's like there's a quiet, silent aspect and there's a shining, illuminating aspect. That's a Hongzhir, one of Dogen's favorite ancestors, was into this silent illumination, which he defined as like knowing without touching things. Again, you could say the knowing is like there's an awareness that's shining to reveal truth. And yet it doesn't touch things. It's like it's quiet, quiescent. This pair, quiescently, it shines bright. I think it's like a mirror. The mirror just, it's not doing anything. It's just resting as total receptivity. And yet it's illuminating, in this case, it illumines objects, it expresses the images that appear on it. It's not just a blank, quiet mirror. It's a silent, resting mirror, and yet it can display very energetic images.
He says it shines bright.
Yeah, so it's
Who says that it doesn't rest mysteriously in dark?
It does. Rest mysteriously in dark, and it shines bright. These are the two sides again. And I think, and particularly these are like, I think the first two positions of Dongshan, like the dark first realization of ultimate, where there's no thing at all, direct being, true nature, and then then that's like as Hakuin says, that's like when the mirror is totally black. And then the mirror gets up from the cushion and it's still a mirror on the second position, and now it's like it's just reflecting all these images, receiving them equanimously. One more just note on those first two positions. The first, the I Ching hexagram that's connected with that is the trigram and the hexagram of wind and also penetrating. It's a kind of like, let's picture like, this is like the energy to break through. We could hear it this way. I don't even know if the commentaries say it this way, but huge wind of letting go, dropping body and mind, everything. And then the second I Ching hexagram for the second position is a lake, which is a reflective. I think the I Ching maybe even gets into that image. The undisturbed surface of a lake that's like a mirror. So first you have this wind to penetrate, break through duality, and then you have the reflective surface of the lake, the black and then the white. Quiescently, it shines bright. You could even hear that as like, first there's this total quiescence, and then it shines bright. You could hear that as the first and the second position. And then it's, you know, fineness, it fits into spaciousness, and its greatness, it is utterly beyond location. A hair's breadth deviation will fail to accord with the proper harmony or attunement. If you're tuning it, like the Buddha has that sutra where he talks about tuning the lute. He's talking about meditation practice and Buddhist practice in general, in the conventional sense of practice. One of his students was practicing too hard. I think in the sutra he has bloody feet from doing too much walking meditation on rough ground. I think you can read the sutra. I think the sutra is like he grew up in such comfort that he had hair growing on the bottom of his feet because he never did anything, and now he's like living out in the forest and like walking in bare feet, and he comes to the Buddha and like, I can't do this anymore. And that's when the Buddha tells the parable of the lute. You're stringing your lute strings too tight. It's not going to play well. But if you just go back to your shag carpeted home, let the hair grow on your feet again, that's too loose. And you won't have nice music. So you tune the strings just right. It's a great metaphor for zazen, I think. We don't want to... You know, zazen's not about pushing, trying harder, forced. It's receptive samadhi, right? And yet, it's quiescent and resting, and yet it shines bright. It's not dull and just wandering mind. Yes.
So deviation implies free will.
Deviation is...
How do you deviate? How does someone do something wrong?
A hair's breadth deviation. Let's see what it is.
How can nature not be nature?
It doesn't imply mindful deviation. Right?
I don't think it's something that we do. I think you could say like... if our understanding of this, that'd be one way to hear it. If our understanding, it has a hair's breadth discrepancy. Mm-hmm. In other words, if we fall into enlightenment or delusion or practice being separate from realization, the word deviation actually can mean discrepancy. I don't think it means that it's we're deviating. It's more like if there is the slightest discrepancy. Actually, this is probably coming from the Xinjin Ming, right? There's that line in that song of the trusting mind that says if there's a hair's breadth discrepancy, the way is as distant as heaven from earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. So I think it's just like, we're just resting in present, open awareness, and then if there's this slight veering into like, even like, how am I doing? Is this it? You know, that would be just a hair's breadth deviation. That's not getting into like, so, what kind of pizza am I gonna order tonight? You know, that'd be like a, what kind of a monster deviation. But a hair's breadth deviation would just be like, maybe even just like, ah, how sweet. That's a hair's breadth deviation. And then it's like that mirror awareness is, you know, we're like separated from it, like the distance between heaven and earth. It's kind of like a strict teaching, right? It's like if you fall into any grasping, a hair's breadth of grasping, then we lose it. Mm-hmm. That's the point. So it's not so much that we're intending volitionally to deviate, it's just that the mind keeps falling off the middle naturally. Or maybe we should say it appears to fall off the middle, because the mind never deviates from the middle, but we think we do, and then we're like, they're like, I shouldn't be thinking about pizza, because this is zazen. Like, oh, but I shouldn't be thinking that either, because it's just natural to think about pizza. Oh, but now I'm like, you know, now I have three layers of shoulds and shouldn'ts. But even the first little bit, it's like, starts to avalanche. Yes.
I'm thinking of Archer, not that I've never done it, but what I understand is that there's this, when I think of this hair's breadth deviation, it's like, you know, you have to be just completely present. If you're thinking, not that there's anything wrong with thinking, you know, it's fine to think, but if you want to actually shoot the arrow, then you need to not be thinking, you know? Or a certain
especially for arrow points to meet head on.
Yeah, and so, you know, the moment that you start thinking, you lose it. You know, so that's how this kind of
works
to me. You know, those kinds of things.
Tightrope walking would be that way. Mm-hmm. Not that I've tried it, but I wouldn't want to think if I was doing it. Yeah, I hear it. And I think this is all celebrating the dual mirror samadhi. So it's like, if we start to, it's like, here's this quote from Baijiang. The immediate mirror-like awareness should not have the slightest hair of grasping love for anything at all. Including love for the dual mirror samadhi. Like, it's good enough to just be the dual mirror samadhi, but like, I love it, so nice, then we're off track. And so it's not so evil or anything, it's just that it's not fully functioning as harmoniously as it could be if we weren't grasping at all.
Misses the mark.
It misses the mark. Or at least it seems to miss the mark. And seeming is enough to throw us into turmoil, as we know. Now there are sudden and gradual in which teachings and approaches arise. So, I think referring to this issue of early Zen in China that also was brought up in the merging of difference and unity. Sudden and gradual Zen schools, going back to that first poem about the mirror. Y'all know the six ancestor mirror poem story, which kind of defines the sudden and gradual. In other words, one version, the gradual practice is like, we have, in both cases, there's like there's mirror awareness actually, right? So this is kind of a hair's breadth difference in understanding the dual mirror. In the gradual approach, there's this mirror awareness, but, like all this dust is landing on the mirror, the dust of our attachments and fixations and habitual patterns, all of that is landing on the mirror. So the gradual practice is to constantly polish the mirror so the dust comes off constantly. which means, like, we could say, means like, let go, let go, let go, let go. Over and over again of this dust that's blocking the quiescent shining of the mirror. And so in the poetry contest, right, that's what the one monk wrote that poem. It's like, we must constantly polish the mirror so no dust alights. And then Workman Lu, who would become the sixth ancestor, said, that seems a little off to me. Can you, I'm illiterate, but excuse me, can you come write this poem for me? Because I don't know how to write, but I have a good poem here. And the poem's like, you know, the basic gist is that the mirror is empty and the dust is empty. Where is there any, how can dust stick to the mirror? So that's the sudden school. And the fifth ancestor liked that poem. And so thus was born the sudden school of Chan, where it's not a matter of polishing over and over. So I think it's good, and you know, many people say when comparing these, just like Sekitoki San, when he compares them, in the path, there are no southern or northern ancestors, and sudden and gradual are not really a matter of like better and worse. They're both valuable practices. And so we could hear, like, in both cases, we have this luminous mirror wisdom, this Buddha nature. One case where, like, I keep getting distracted by my thoughts of, like, let them go. Let them go, polish. Good practice. Maybe I'm in practice. And then maybe even in the midst of that, you could say it's gradual because it's like, it's not, I think sudden, another word for sudden would be like imminent. It's not so much that, you know, one of them is about like it's over time, and imminent means like it's already the case, you know, rather than like, your experience is sudden or gradual. I hear more like there's a time-based approach that you do over time, and one is like the imminent, already perfectly complete Buddha nature, where there's nothing to do.
Practice and realization.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Sudden and gradual are like the gradual practice. Could, it doesn't necessarily, but this is a way to unite them, right? You could just be practicing gradually, like, I've been doing this for so long, and like, my delusions don't seem to be decreasing at all, and like, there's just as much dust as ever, and I wonder if this is worth it. I'm getting tired of polishing this mirror. And then the other way would be like, I'm polishing it, but like, right in the polishing, there's actually these thoughts that I'm letting go of are, what are they actually? I mean, that's the approach to the imminent. It's like, these thoughts that seem to be blocking the clarity of the mirror, are they really like these dust particles that need to be removed by even just letting them go? Or are they like, maybe they don't even need to be removed if we see that the thoughts are actually not thoughts? So it's just like the emptiness approach. And we could say, and then we could keep enacting. But okay, yeah, they're empty, and let's at the same time, let's keep letting go of them. It might get tricky because we might start falling into like, and I really, now they're becoming less empty again. Maybe that's part, that would be the true integration, would be like, there's an empty thought and I'm letting go of it, but not because it's blocking the mirror, because it's really not. It's because it is an emanation of the mirror. The thought is a manifestation of mirror awareness. So how could it block it? How could it? Its very nature is mirror awareness. But we could still keep, let's enact the letting go to kind of like celebrate the fact that it can be let go. Or let's like, or it could even be that seeing the emptiness of the thought is let go of. It's a little bit different than the thought's really, or the thought or the feeling or the grasping, whatever, has really got me, and it's just, we've got to really, like, how are we going to work with this? It's taking me over. Then it's really got some solidity for us. So maybe in particular, maybe even because it's that sudden and gradual thing first comes from this mirror story. Maybe that's why he brings it up in this dual mirror samadhi. There's these sudden and gradual approaches in which teachings and approaches arise. Teachings could also be translated as schools, like it's the, what we call the Soto Shu, the Soto school or sect. That character Shu is this one. So it's a kind of one of those dynamic characters that means sect or religious sect or school, but also means source. Completely different meanings, but that's the character. So you could hear it as now there are sudden and gradual in which schools and their approaches arise, different like schools of Buddhism or Zen, like northern and southern schools.
The gradual school settled in the north, and
yeah,
the sudden school was probably in another thing.
In the south, yep, in the south. Where Cao Chi, the six ancestors' temples in the south, which was on this China trip, I'm recalling, we made this long trip down to visit that temple, and there wasn't that, maybe there were a few others around there, but I think in those early days, a lot was in the north.
And again, the gradual was the north?
The gradual was the north of China. And in those really early days, I get, you know...
But when they say northern and southern school, that's what they're referring to.
Yeah, so I take that back about this China trip, because that was all after everything was considered the southern school. Everything after the sixth ancestor was considered southern school. All Zen lineages that survived, all the five houses of Zen are all... come from the sixth ancestor. So everything is sudden. There were these few lineages of northern school, like the Oxhead school and some others, that died out pretty quickly. So everything that we know of as Zen now is considered imminent, sudden, southern school. Sudden and gradual, in which teachings or the sort, we could also hear it as in which the source and approaches arise, which is another one of those pairs, like the source and then the approaches to the source. You could translate it like that. Or schools and approaches, or teachings and approaches. Once basic approaches, and actually it's the same character if you see there, this source or, you know, teachings and approach, is there in the next line too. It really should say, once teachings and approaches are distinguished, then there are guiding rules. And then the next line is, even though the teaching is reached and the approach comprehended. So those two characters are in like three lines in a row. These two, this pair of like teachings and approaches, or source and approach. So there are guiding rules or standards. Actually, it's interesting, literally those Chinese characters for guiding standards are a compass and a T-square. Like an architect's or a carpenter's compass to draw circles and a T-square. So they're like these tools by which you measure and standardize things. Once once teachings and approaches are distinguished, then you have compasses and T-squares and like dual mirror samadhi, like manuals with these circular diagrams and I Ching hexagrams and pencils and pens and computers and Google. But even though the basis is reached, or the teaching is reached, and the approach comprehended, true eternity still flows. And I'll just end with this part here. True eternity still flows. It's that same character for true as intention. You could maybe translate it as like, the true constantly flows. Instead of true eternity, you could say the true or the genuine constantly flows. Even though, I don't know if it actually says, but it doesn't really actually say but or even though, which kind of implies a different, you know, two different meanings. That's not in there. It just says schools comprehended, meaning realized, the true constantly flows. If you say but, then it makes this flow sound kind of negative, right? And I think there are these two interpretations. If you say, even though all this is happening, still there's this flow, and the character flow is what's used for this Sanskrit word ashrava, which means outflows, or because it outflows or taints. So those studying these early sutras, we had this one of those, the Buddha's awakening night. He says, at the third watch of the night, I saw the taints, the origin of the taints, the cessation of the taints, and the path leading to the cessation of the taints. It's ashrava, or Pali, I think, asava. And this is the way they do it in Chinese, translate it. And then he says, the taint or the outflow of sense desires, grasping the sensory world, the outflow of becoming, which I think is like, very briefly we could say like, the sense of like becoming a self again and again, maybe roughly speaking, and the taint or outflow of ignorance, basic delusion, again around the self of a person and the self of things. So if you hear it in that negative way, and one commentary says this refers to defiled ashrava outflows. So if you hear it that way, it's like, even though the basis is reached and the approach comprehended, still the truth is kind of like this is undercurrent of like this very, very subtle outflow of truth. The truth is still is tainted by subtle delusion. That would be one way to hear it. I don't like to hear it that way. Maybe that's an outflow because it's a preference. But I think more commonly it's that reality constantly flows. Yeah, truth is flowing.
Regardless of what we're talking, words and what we think.
Yeah, exactly.
Blah, blah, blah,
yeah,
blah.
Yeah, yeah. Almost like it was all kind of based on these practices, right? There's sudden and gradual. There's schools and approaches, and then you work with it. You finally realize the source, work the path and the practice. But meanwhile, you could say reality is just flowing. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but do you mean that, you know, tension, zenki, or do you mean outflows?
What do you mean?
Is true reality flowing the way, you know...
Naturally real?
Heaven?
Yeah.
Heaven is,
yeah. I think we could read it either way. You know, it's interesting. And I think Tenchin Roshi himself, in talking about this dual mirror samadhi over the years, I think I've heard him interpret it both different ways at different times, talking about, oh, there's a subtle outflow of, you know, making it into something. Because the next line is talking about tethered cults and trapped rats. That would be one, that would be maybe the main way you could interpret as an outflow. Like tethered cults and trapped rats. It goes right into that. But you could hear it as flowing, and then now we're going to talk about tethered cults and trapped rats.
There's a period, after all.
What's that? Flow. There's a period, yeah. Well, except in Chinese, there's no periods. In China, there's no periods. But there are lines, there's broken up lines. You know. So I think this is Charlie Picorni's thought about this, is that the Dongshan himself has this teaching of, he addressed the assembly saying, to know the person who goes beyond Buddha, you must be capable of a bit of expression. And a monk asked, what kind of person goes beyond Buddha? And Dongshan said, not Buddha. So you could hear going beyond Buddha is like, there's this flowing. I think the going beyond is, has this sense of like flowing beyond. We mean what we're doing in this practice, and meanwhile there's this continuous, non-stop flow of going beyond. Also, like he brings up when Dongshan said, I, you know, half agree and half don't agree with my teacher. And if I fully agreed, I would be ungrateful to him. It's a little bit like there's this flowing beyond also. Yeah. So I just end with this story about, related to our lineage, I think an unpublished story about Kishizawa Ion and Nishihari Bokusan. We've heard a couple other stories about that, that teacher and student. There's this story about the calligraphy of the iron person. You might remember that one. Asking his friend to ask the teacher to do calligraphy of iron person. That's the same two characters, yeah. Kishizawa Ion was one of Suzuki Roshi's teacher. He's not like Suzuki Roshi's the Dharma heir of Gyokujin So-on, but he then went on to study Shobo Genzo mostly with Kishizawa Ion, was like a Shobo Genzo scholar. And Kishizawa Ion was the student of who lived right nearby Suzuki Roshi's temple, so he could like walk over there to go to these talks. It was very fortunate. And Nishihari Bokusan was Kishizawa Ion's teacher, and was one of those great revivers. We have his commentary on the Genjo Koan. We might start studying tomorrow in our breakfast study group. So Kishizawa Ion asked, when he was a student, I think this is at Eheiji, he asked Nishihari Bokusan Roshi something like, it was raining and the temple bell was ringing at the same time. And he said the sound of the, he was just like in Dokusan, you know, and there, maybe you can picture it. It's raining on the Dokusan room roof and the bell's ringing in the distance. And he says, the sounds of the bell, the raindrops and the roof, the water splashing along the gutter, where do these sounds meet? Interesting question. They're like all simultaneous, but like these different things happening in different places. Where do they meet? And Nishihari Bokusan replied, bring me the mirror and I'll break it for you. Which, you know, in terms of what we're talking about, the mirror that's reflecting the sound of the raindrops, the sound of the bell, the sound of the gutter, equally reflecting all of that, this precious, precious mirror. Where do they meet here in the mirror? Do they meet here in this precious mirror? Bring me this mirror and I'll break it for you. at a hair's breadth deviation from being that mirror. Well, it's the distance between heaven and earth. Bring it to me and I'll break it for you. And then young Kishizawa Ion said, what does that mean? And Ishihara Boku-san said, true eternity still flows. Quoting the Jewel Mirror Samadhi.
The outflow version?
Yes.
Again, we could hear it either way, right? Again, we could hear it either way of, you know, why you're asking what that means, or what does it mean when the mirror is broken?
Yeah.
What does it mean after you break my mirror, true eternity still flows?
Not yet, the real thing.
Yeah. Not even this, no more idea of a mirror that's precious, precious mirror. So precious. Don't disturb it, please. Don't break my mirror. And interesting, you know, like, bring it to me and I'll break it. Well, only with that one. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become.